guys, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. It's October the 22nd, 2005, and it's my honor to welcome back to the show Michael Scheuer. He is formerly known as Anonymous, the head analyst at the CIA's Bin Laden unit, Alex Station, from 1996 to 1999. He is the author of Through Our Enemy's Eyes, Osama Bin Laden, Radical Islam, and the Future of America, and Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terrorism. He's now an adjunct professor of security studies at Georgetown University. Welcome back to the show, Mike.
Thank you very kindly, Scott. It's nice of you to have me again.
Sure, it's great to have you on. Now, well, let's just start with the key phrase. You've said it before quite a few times. America is Osama bin Laden's indispensable ally. That's what you said when you came on this show last February. Is that still the case?
It's still the case. And frankly, Scott, I've had almost no luck in persuading people to look at it from that dimension, but the growth of Islamic militancy around the world has been rather distressing, to say the least. We are, as a country, sort of boresighted on Iraq and Afghanistan. But if you step back for a moment and you look at what's going on in the Philippines, in Indonesia, in southern Thailand, in Bangladesh, in northern Nigeria, bin Laden's goal of igniting, if you will, a worldwide Islamic insurgency, it seems to be catching fire. And Islam itself, the Islamic world, is so divided in terms of sectarianism, in terms of the differing theological interpretations of Islam, not to mention ethnically and linguistically across the billion-plus Muslim world, that the only glue available for bin Laden to focus on has been U.S. foreign policy in the Islamic world. And that has worked, I think, extraordinarily well.
We're helping them paper over all their differences with each other so that they can face us, their common enemy.
Indeed, sir. I think what you could say is something akin to a glue of unity in a world that is every much as fractured and divided as the Western world is, with the exception that the most important thing in the world to most Muslims is his religion. And bin Laden's framing of American foreign policy, and a plausible framing, from at least the Islamic perspective, as a threat to the survival of Islam, does indeed provide a glue of unity that otherwise would not be there.
Well, and, you know, I hate to give the guy too much credit, but he, I have to say, may very well be onto something there. If you read An End to Evil by Richard Pearl and David Frum, it's clear that Islam itself is the enemy, and that's exactly what we're fighting against.
Well, I'm afraid, you know, for a long time I was reluctant to say that people wanted this kind of a conflict with Islam, but I don't know if it's frustration from not having my point of view listened to very much or it's reality, but there does seem to be at least a section of the American elite that doesn't mind the idea of bringing on a confrontation between us and Islam as a culture, as a civilization.
Yeah, well, war is the health of the state, unless you lose.
Well, that's right, and unfortunately, they're fighting a war, if that is indeed what they want, that they cannot possibly win on the terms that they think are necessary.
All right, everybody, we're talking with Mike Scheuer. He's the former head of the Bin Laden unit at the Central Intelligence Agency, and we'll be right back. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Michael Scheuer. He's the author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terrorism. He's the former head analyst at Alex Station, the CIA's Bin Laden unit. And before the break, sir, you were saying that basically it's impossible to win the war on terror the way we're fighting it now, with the understanding upon which we're fighting the war on terrorism now. And I thought I could cut right to that by bringing up Bush's speech at the National Endowment for Democracy a couple of weeks ago. There are two major points that stuck out to me. The first thing he said was 9/11 happened before the second Iraq war. So Michael Scheuer's idea that it's made the problem worse is ridiculous.
Well, the president is, you know, I grew up in a world where the president was always the most respected individual, and I find myself having
guess I'm too known for that
about condemning the president. But that is surely a statement worthy of a horse's behind. Iraq was not part of 9/11, of course. And what Iraq did was to make sure that our efforts to eliminate those who conducted 9/11 would be unsuccessful. The invasion of Iraq simply broke the back of U.S. counterterrorism policy because it validated what bin Laden had said. It brought the clerical community of the Islamic world into the war on the side of bin Laden. And more than anything else, it has created a situation where the flow of fighters to various Islamic insurgencies around the world has increased and will remain steady. So with due respect for the office that Mr. Bush holds, I can't imagine a more ludicrous argument than that.
I think it was Karen Katowski who made the analogy of the Wahhabists and the neoconservatives. Nobody really listens to them until things are on fire and their bodies laying around everywhere. And all of a sudden now, hey, let's see what Paul Wolfowitz thinks we should do. And if you're in the Middle East, then as you just said, you know, we go into Iraq and all of a sudden all these clerics who didn't take Osama seriously now do.
That's absolutely the case. And the real danger is that the enemy we're facing now is not just Salafist or Wahhabist. It is across the board. The Americans, I believe, really unreflectively in terms of many of the people in our government, invaded in a Muslim country and satisfied all the requirements in terms of the Quran and the sayings of the Prophet and Islamic jurisprudence for a defensive jihad against the United States. There's no way to fudge that factor anymore. The whole business about Islam being a religion of peace, I think to some extent that's true, but not when it's attacked. There is nothing more certain than a religion attacked will defend itself with every weapon available to it.
Mike, if you'd been the National Security Advisor on 9/11, could you have orchestrated a policy for getting retribution, for killing the people involved, getting bin Laden and Zawahiri, and yet committing this violence in such a way that you're not putting them, not making them legitimate, not making them able to say, see, we're fighting a defensive war. America's the aggressor, not us.
Well, certainly we had an opportunity. We had a window in which much of the Islamic world and certainly all of the Western world were on our side. We had an opportunity to apply American military power with a ferocity that was similar to that we used after Pearl Harbor, for example. But I think one of the unspoken scandals that has really not been covered at all, Scott, is the fact that when 9/11 happened, the most powerful and most costly military on the face of the earth had no plans on the shelf. When President Bush turned to Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld and the generals had nothing to offer him.
Yeah, it took him almost a month to even get to Afghanistan.
Yes, sir. And everybody was gone home with their guns for the most part when by the time we hit. You know, Al-Qaeda in its own journals has talked very much about that gap between 9/11 and 7 October, and which they used to evacuate much of their fighting force out of Afghanistan in order to fight another day.
Right, yeah. You say in your book that, I believe it was in Imperial Hubris, that a lot of the Mujahideen cried. They didn't want to go home, but bin Laden sent them home and said, go home and train new guys.
Yep, there was no need for them at the time because Al-Qaeda was going to be on the defensive until this summer when we can now see the cost of not having been prepared to strike on 9/11, which is just inexplicable to me because the intelligence was there. Bin Laden had helped us himself by declaring war publicly on us twice in 96 and 98. So could I have offered some advice? I think advice is one thing, but to go with the advice, you have to be prepared, and we were sorely unprepared, sir.
Okay, now another thing that George Bush said in his speech is that we can't leave Iraq. And the idea that we must leave Iraq sometime soon, George Bush says, is refuted by the simple question. Would we be better off if Osama bin Laden and Zarqawi ran Iraq? So my question to you is whether you think that that's possible, that were America to leave, would al-Qaeda be able to turn Iraq into a terrorist state like they had done to Afghanistan?
I think it's very unlikely in the near term. Iraqis are very nationalistic people. They have their own scores to settle. They have their own country to restructure. If we left, I don't think they would welcome in non-Iraqis to run their country. I think that is that's a fatuous argument. But that said, if we do leave, and we will at one point or another, what we've done is, no matter who governs Iraq, we have provided al-Qaeda with something that it did not have before, and that is a contiguous safe haven next to the Levant. They now, if we leave Iraq, Iraq will remain unsettled and unstable, and al-Qaeda will use its forces from Iraq to project itself into Syria, into Jordan, into Egypt, eventually into Lebanon, into Israel. So the problem we have is that we've opened a Pandora's box, and Zawahiri himself has you know, written a prayer that thanks God for the Americans going to Iraq, because if they stay, they will lose, and if they go, they will lose. And that's kind of the situation we're facing at the moment.
And in fact, we've already seen, assuming the reports can be believed, a couple of months ago, when guys shot rockets at an American ship in Jordan, it turns out that they were trained and radicalized fighting Americans in Iraq. We've already spread the jihadists out of Iraq and to other countries in the Middle East.
That's right, sir. And more recently, we've also seen it flow the other way into Saudi Arabia. People trained in Iraq were engaged with the Saudis in a gunfight in the industrial city of Jebel. And so The contiguity of Iraq to the Persian Gulf states and to the Levant is something that al-Qaeda never had before, and it's something that they value very highly.
Okay, now, when it comes to Iraq, it seems to me that it were America to go, really all the power is in the hands of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq and the Dawa Party in the south, and then the Kurdish Peshmergas have all the power in the north. So it seems like, first of all, the Sunni Arabs would have to somehow win their minority power back over the Kurds and the Shiites, and then they would have to basically allow al-Qaeda to come in and usurp them. So I'm not even sure if we left that the Shiites and their Badr brigades and the Kurdish Peshmergas wouldn't just take care of the al-Qaeda problem in Iraq themselves.
Well, to some extent, that certainly is a possibility. But what we've done really, though, is if we leave, the box that we've opened is going to be kind of a geopolitical cockpit for an extended period of time, because the Turks, for example, don't want the Kurds to be too powerful. The Iranians will join with the Shias in Iraq to make sure that the Sunnis don't come back. But in terms of the Sunnis themselves, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, and all of the Gulf states, the last thing they want is another major Shia power in the Middle East. So they will funnel money and guns and fighters to the Sunnis. So we really have, it's happening already, but certainly if we leave, the kind of geopolitical contest between Shia and Sunni will be played out in Iraq.
Is there any chance you think that this is on purpose? Is this just imperial hubris and people so full of themselves they think they can just do whatever they want with no consequences? Because if I were to just put on my conspiracy theory hat for a minute and look at, you know, it's widely reported by Borger in The Guardian, by James Bamford, by Bob Dreyfus, that Ariel Sharon set up a rump intelligence unit to help lie us into war in Iraq. And is it possible that this was really the plan, was to set up the makings of the perfect storm of an intra-Muslim civil war between the Shia and the Sunni?
Well, there is that possibility. I think it's... You'd have to assume there's an awful lot of demented people in the world to have tried to pull something off like that. And I think objectively, the biggest loser in the long run from the Iraq war will be Israel. because the growth of Islamic militancy that's being spurred by the war is that ultimately Israel will pay the price, because ultimately the kind of non-intervention or isolationist attitude of the Americans will play itself out, and we'll get tired of bleeding for other people's interests.
Right, and really, the Israelis, they're sort of like us. They're stuck fighting the last war. They thought what they wanted to do was smash that big, powerful nation state into thirds, and what they've ended up doing is creating circumstances that are even more dangerous for themselves, just as we've done.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely correct, Scott.
All right, everybody, we're talking with Michael Scheuer, formerly known as Anonymous, author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terrorism. We'll be right back.
Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
Weekend interview show. I'm Scott Horton. I keep all the interviews in MP3 format for you at weekendinterviewshow.com. Also, you can find me writing some articles and on the blog at antiwar.com. You can also find a few articles, at least, by my current guest, Michael Scheuer, at antiwar.com. Michael Scheuer is the former head analyst at the Bin Laden unit at the CIA from 1996 to 99, and he's the author of the book Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terrorism. Now, Mike, you retired from the CIA just about a year ago. Why is that?
Yes, sir, I resigned rather than retired. I thought that the 9/11 Commission had been an exercise in really duplicity and whitewashing, and had completely ignored the rather substantial personal culpability of the intelligence community's leaders for what happened on 9/11. And I wanted to speak out about that issue. I left the agency with great regrets. I think it's the best place to work in America, and I would have been tickled to be able to have stayed my 30 years there. But it had come time, it sounds corny, but it was time to be a good citizen rather than just a good employee. And as you can see, I've had massive influence on this issue. Everyone has gotten off scot-free, and I'm afraid we'll rue the day that anyone ever invented or formed the 9/11 Commission.
Oh, yeah, well, no doubt about that, although I think you may sell yourself maybe too short on how much influence you've had. It's not like you're going to change Dick Cheney's mind about anything, but there are a lot of people in America who are very familiar with Mike Scheuer and his list of six reasons why we're at war with these Al-Qaeda guys.
Well, I hope that's the case, because I think Americans are a lot smarter and certainly a lot more courageous than their leaders are. And can face the truth and saddle up and move on and make sure their country and their children are protected. But it's been it's kind of a long slog. And when you hear President Bush and the leaders, Ms. Pelosi on the other side and Senator Kerry, continue to pump this out to the American people that they hate our civilization and our values and our elections and gender equality, it's a long uphill slog, and it's very detrimental for America in the long run.
What is that list of six reasons?
Well, basically,
I'm sure they're not gender equality.
No, no, they're not. And to be fair, if Bin Laden ran an Islamic State, it would not look like the United States of America. It would be guided by religious principles according to the light he sees them under. But really, no one is going to blow up a car bomb in Iraq or drive into a building in the United States in an airplane because we have gender equality. This is all about U.S. policy. It's about our unqualified support for Israel. It's about our ability until recently to keep oil prices at levels acceptable to Western consumers. It's our support, thirdly, for governments that are oppressing Muslims, whether it is Putin in Chechnya, the Indian government in Kashmir, or the Chinese genocide against the Uyghurs in Western China. It's our presence on the Arabian Peninsula. The fifth thing I would note is our presence in military presence in other Islamic countries, Iraq and Yemen, Mindanao in the Philippines, Afghanistan. And perhaps most seriously of all, or the thing that provides so much of the support for bin Laden and his allies, is American protection, whether it's military, diplomatic, political, or economic, for police states and tyrannies across the Islamic world. Whether it's Egypt or Saudi Arabia or Algeria or Kuwait, these are really the core of what motivates people to support bin Laden and what caused many millions of Muslims to perceive a U.S. attack on their faith and on their brethren.
You said last time we talked that Ayatollah Khomeini had spent the 1980s trying to rally people to hate America because of how degenerate and free we are, and that didn't work.
It really didn't work.
Here comes bin Laden saying, hey, everybody, here's my list of six things that the American government does in our part of the world, and all of a sudden, everybody's signing up.
Awful lot of people sign up. You know, we have more car bombs in Iraq in a week than we've had in the past 30 years. And, you know, it's just kind of common sense, at least I think it should be, that very few people are going to blow up a car bomb because you or I have a draft beer after dinner and or after work. But many, many people are going to kill themselves fighting us because we are viewed as occupying the homeland of the Prophet Muhammad. We don't have to, you know, say that our policies are wrong. That's eventually up for the American people to decide. But unless you recognize what motivates your enemy, then you are going to lose whatever conflict you're involved in.
Well, and even to this day, even though, you know, all the rumors are that Cheney might have to resign by this time next week, the statements of Condoleezza Rice and the rest of them are that the foreign policy of regional transformation is moving ahead of pace, and that we are going to remake the entire Middle East, and that's going to stop the terrorism.
I don't think there's much chance of that, but they do seem determined to try, don't they?
They don't seem to be backing off one bit. Rice said about Iran and Syria the other day, we're not ruling out military action. All right, folks, we're talking with Mike Scheuer. He's the author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. And we'll be right back after this short commercial break. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. I'm talking with Michael Scheuer, author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terrorism. And, Mike, I don't really want to hover too long over the same subject here in terms of the motivation of our enemies and how we need to go about taking away the power of the terrorist recruiters. But this idea of regional transformation, I have to admit, if I didn't know what I know, I might even fall for it. The idea of somehow bringing the Muslim world into the 21st century with the rest of us is very appealing in a lot of ways to a lot of people. And the idea, as enunciated by Condoleezza Rice, I think probably more than anyone else, that the reason that people become terrorists is because they're poor, it's because they're hopeless, they live under some tyranny, they have nothing to live for anymore, so they come to America to kill people. And if only we can create wealthy, modern, capitalistic societies in the Middle East, which is a long, hard slog, and it's going to be tough, but when we're done, it's going to be great. 30 years from now, there will be no more terrorism, and every Middle Eastern state will have a big shopping mall in their capital, and everything will be fine then. Are they that far off? Are they working toward the same end as you, but just from a different direction?
You know, I don't think so. I think that it's I think a couple of things. The idea that, first of all, that it's America's job to change the way other people live is something that is not at all consonant with what the founders intended America to be. So basically it's a non-role for America. The idea, the further idea that we can change another religion without violence and without really endless war just betrays a gross ignorance of our own history. You know, our own Reformation and Counter-Reformation entailed 100 years of religious wars before we had it straightened out with a separation of church and state. I'm not sure if we want to be fighting Muslims for 100 years. The third thing I would say is just Mr. Bush and Ms. Rice and Mr. Cheney, I'm sad to say that they seem to have no knowledge or no appreciation for the struggle that Americans have expended over, really, since Runnymede, for 800 years to get to the state of the democracy we're in now. The struggles and the civil wars and the segregation and the world wars and the lynchings and all of that we've suffered through and overcome took 800 years. And for these people to think, and again, I think it's on both sides of the political aisle, to think that they can put that experience on a CD-ROM and send it to Iraq and send it to Afghanistan and think that in, you know, 15 days, 15 months, or 15 years, that's going to be acted on and perfected. I think that's just a slap at the American people and a betrayal of what they've accomplished.
What about the premise that the terrorists are poor, helpless people who are so frustrated that they end up lashing out because they have nothing else to do with their life?
That has been a shibboleth. It's a shibboleth now. It used to be the common wisdom and also supported by academic studies, but among the many plates and dishes that have been shattered in the kitchen by Osama bin Laden, that is one that has been primarily destroyed. Al-Qaeda and its allies are overwhelmingly middle-class and upper-middle-class men. They're people who generally come from good families, who have comfortable living circumstances, who were educated, many to the graduate degree level. They're people with a future, and they appeal to the same sort of person in the Islamic world. It's not a coincidence that Al-Qaeda and its allies have put extraordinary effort and investment into working the Internet. Al-Qaeda's broadest appeal, most important appeal, is to the educated in the Islamic world, to those who do have money, to those who do have a good education, to those who do have a future. Increasingly, the argument that poverty drives terrorism is just a shibboleth, something that is said very facilely but with almost no truth to back it up.
All right, now, I've read an article, I guess about 6 months ago, something like that, a CIA guy, I forget his rank, I think he was some sort of deputy director of operations or something, a guy named A.B. Buzzy Krongard.
Yes.
He came out and he said, listen, guys, we got to let bin Laden live. If we kill him now, we're only going to make everything much, much worse by making a martyr out of him. Let him die of old age, because if you kill him and deliver his head on a platter, he's going to live forever.
He's going to live forever one way or another. I know Mr. Krongard very well, and I was never really confident that he had a handle on this situation. Bin Laden, as a historical figure, is a great man. I think I've said that to you before, Scott. He has changed the course of history. He has certainly changed the course of the way Americans live their lives, whether it has to do with travel, entering government buildings, worrying about what your neighbor's up to, our lives have been changed. It's not to say that it's a positive greatness, but very few individuals can be said to have changed the course of history. Bin Laden is one of them. He is a man that merits death, not only for what he does, what he's done, but for what he's doing. He's an extraordinary combination of a medieval theologian and a 21st century CEO. He runs an organization that's absolutely unique in modern Islamic history. And to leave him live any longer than necessary is a tragic mistake.
Besides just being preoccupied with going into Iraq as soon as possible, why do you think that they've let him go? I mean, could they not just drop some special forces guys into Pakistan somewhere and cut this guy's throat or what?
Well, you know, Scott, I think Americans tend to forget that the FBI couldn't find Eric Rudolph in North Carolina for a year. And bin Laden lives in the Himalayas, the highest mountains on Earth. in an area that's not governed by any central government, supported by a population that values protecting its guests with their lives. And also we neglect to think that he is the most important Islamic leader and hero in the world today. People are not going to turn him in. It's not so easy to find him. If Clinton had taken the chance to kill him when he had the chance multiple times, it would be over. But we may get lucky. You know, you work hard and sometimes you get lucky. And I know the agency and the special forces guys are working their brains out to try to get bin Laden. But it's a huge task. And so much of our resources, not only in terms of human beings and armaments, but collection capabilities, whether it's from satellites or from the National Security Agency, have been directed at Iraq, that we just don't have enough to go around. So I think it's everybody gets a chuckle out of one man evading the United States of America, but it is an extraordinarily difficult problem.
You bring up Clinton there. I believe I've read where you've written before that at one point, at least, Clinton said to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, listen, I want you guys to send in some black-clad ninja guys or something to kill these guys, and that the DOD just said no. And that,
yeah,
Clinton just said, oh, okay.
Well, it's extraordinary in American history, I think, at least in my experience of American history, that although Clinton needs to take a lot of blame for what he did and didn't do, he was a warrior when it came to this issue. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff just kind of defied him. And Clinton let him get away with it, the same way that Louis Freeh would refuse to talk to the president. And Clinton let him get away with that. So I don't give Clinton high marks for anything. But he did have a sense of the importance of this problem. And he, frankly, didn't have the moral courage to force the issue.
What was your relationship with John O'Neill at the FBI?
It was a rocky relationship. I think that the Bureau has, with its really marvelous public relations machine, has created in the aftermath of his death a heroic figure who in real life was really detested by almost everyone who knew him. I thought that O'Neill probably was one of the single most important handicaps to effectively capturing Osama bin Laden that I encountered in my career.
Really?
Yeah.
And you're right about the PR then, if that's the case, because the PR would have it that this was the man obsessed with Al-Qaeda more than anyone else, and if only people would have listened to him, everything would have been fine.
Yeah, well, he told the agency, he told me personally, the FBI had no interest in capturing Osama bin Laden if they couldn't bring him to the United States for a trial. And the FBI is extraordinarily powerful in the upper councils of the United States government, and John O'Neill and Dale Watson and Louis Freeh and the rest of them often got their way. But I just thought, it's not really polite to speak ill of the dead, but I thought there was something biblical about the fact that O'Neill died in the 9/11 attack, because I think part of his behavior certainly brought on the possibility of that attack occurring.
And that was just his lack of willingness to cooperate with you guys at CIA?
Yeah. I think that's a big part of it. Not only with us, but with anyone else in the government. The motto of the FBI is always FBI first, America if it's convenient, and nobody else counts. Most of these senior FBI guys are really just allegiance is first and foremost to the institution and making sure it survives and flourishes. That is a jaundiced view. It's my view of what I encountered over my career. But O'Neill, it's extraordinary how his rehabilitation and death has occurred.
What you say about the FBI protecting themselves first at all costs, that's the story I hear from all the FBI whistleblowers I've talked to, like Frederick Whitehurst and Sibel Edmonds, et cetera.
Well, Scott, if you look at, we'll go back to the 9/11 Commission. Somehow Louis Freeh is out there with his book now bashing on everyone. Well, why did the FBI fail at 9/11? Well, the personalities were certainly part of it, but the bigger part of it was the fact that Louis Freeh, in his complete tenure, could not find a way to buy a computer system that would allow the FBI to work in the 20th century. And the 9/11 Commission let him get away with it.
Right. Wasn't there a story about how they actually had the money appropriated, but then he used it for something trivial instead?
Well, he either used it for something else or they wasted it on systems that wouldn't work. And, you know, Mr. Mueller has done the same thing. The FBI still doesn't have a computer system that works. You know, technology isn't the answer for the war against terrorism, but certainly you can't win the war without it. And the reality that hundreds of millions of dollars have been wasted at the FBI under Louis Freeh and Mr. Mueller, and they still don't have a computer system, certainly to me suggests there's personal culpability somewhere.
It would seem like it. And speaking of personal culpability, I want to get into the Oklahoma City bombing case a little bit. This is a story I followed very closely, and I don't think that there's, as far as I know, very hard evidence. But it seems to me at least possible and perhaps even likely that Terry Nichols was involved with Ramzi Youssef, Wali Khan Amin Shah, and Abdul Hakim Murad when he was in the Philippines. And in fact, the day of the Oklahoma bombing, it said that Abdul Hakim Murad took credit for it from his jail cell in New York. And I wonder whether you guys at the CIA ever followed that story or whether you believe that McVeigh and Nichols did it themselves or what.
Well, certainly we followed in the sense that there was a kind of a mobilization of efforts on the day it occurred and the day after, because we thought it probably was one or another of the Islamist groups that were fighting in the world. But after that, it became a matter really that was restricted to the FBI, and the information was kept there. I remember hearing something about the possibility that Nichols had buddied around with Wali Khan and Ramzi Youssef, but I'm afraid, Scott, that's about the extent of what I know about that issue.
Okay. Have you ever heard, just one more small question on that topic, have you ever heard of a terrorist named Melvin Lattimore, a.k.a. Mojahid Manepta?
I've never heard that name, sir.
Okay. Well, I'll just have to save those questions for another guest then.
Yes. you stumped me on that one.
Okay. So, yeah, let's get back into tactics here and how we're going to fight these guys. There's something, Mike, that about the way you answer these questions that I admit just bothers the hell out of me sometimes when you say that we have to go in here and kill these people savagely and mercilessly to show them that we really mean business, etc. Well, we can't treat this like police work. We can't just arrest these guys one at a time. This is a war, and we're not being brutal enough. And I wonder, what we've accomplished with our invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and the deaths of all the innocents that America has caused, if that's done nothing but increase the recruitment for al-Qaeda, who is it exactly that you're suggesting we kill so mercilessly?
Well, I think what's happened, Scott, is the adventure in Iraq has given military force a bad name. Not only have we lost 2,000 soldiers, but we've killed an awful lot of people that didn't need to be killed in Iraq. So I think we're really talking about two different issues. Had there not been an Iraq, I think the application of American military force should have been much more drastic than it was.
In terms of, like, the battle at Tora Bora.
At Tora Bora, in Afghanistan entirely. The borders should have been closed and the country should have been ransacked until we had eliminated the Taliban and al-Qaeda, and then we could have come home. The problem is we tried to do it on the cheap. We didn't kill very many of these guys. They went home with their guns, and now we're facing them again. And now it's much harder to kill them. You know, I think there is, too, Scott, a certain failure that's becoming more and more apparent in the educational system of the United States. I find teaching now at Georgetown that there's really not a sound sense of what war entails, in that you should never go to war if you don't intend to win. And I think the politicians have proven, certainly in the last 15 years, that they don't intend to win. I think the humanity, if you will, or the compassion, is to get the war over as quickly as possible. That often entails killing an awful lot of people. But over the long term, you stop the activity, and you can enter into some kind of a rebuilding process. the nature of the war we're fighting. The president, you know, has not explained this to the American people. No one has.
But, Mike, you've said yourself, they are fighting the defensive. We are the empire. We don't have the right to win.
Well, we have the right to defend ourselves. I think what's happened because of Iraq is many people forgot that we were attacked on 9/11.
All right, I'm sorry to cut you here, but we have to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Michael Scheuer, the author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terrorism. Talking with Michael Scheuer, the formerly anonymous head of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, Alex Station. He's the author of Through Our Enemy's Eyes, Osama Bin Laden, Radical Islam, and the Future of America, and also Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terrorism. Now, I wanted to let you get back to your answer real quick, but I also want to mention, too, when you talk about what little effect you're having, I saw CIA anti-terrorism school on the news one night, and they were all reading Through Our Enemy's Eyes by Michael Scheuer. Or by Anonymous.
I was told that they were using it as a training book, and I'm pleased because I think it's a very objective book. I tried to be. On the question, you know, Scott, on the use of military force, when people take me to task for that, and they should if they disagree, but the other part of my argument has been that you only need that military force until you disengage from the Middle East. You need to change our policies. You need to find a way to get America out of the way, because basically that's why we're being attacked, because we're there.
Right.
If it wasn't for us, they'd be trying to destroy the Al Saud family, for example, and the Israelis and the Egyptians and the Jordanians and all of those people that have oppressed them over the last half century and more. And the problem is for America that we're stuck. We're stuck on Israel. We're stuck on oil. We're stuck certainly in this belief that we're ordained to bring democracy to the world.
Well, it's funny you say stuck on oil. On your Wikipedia entry, they have a quote from you, or I guess you're quoting Bin Laden as saying, "Man, you guys can buy our oil. I can't drink it.
Yeah.
It's not worth anything to me. It's for sale." And I said, hey, isn't that great? The United States of America being lectured on free markets and private property by Osama Bin Laden.
Yeah.
So it doesn't cost $300 billion in an unprovoked invasion to buy oil. It costs $1 a gallon.
Yeah. It's a situation, I think, that the American people will understand if it's ever brought to them, except there's just no politician out there who's going to do it, as far as I can tell.
Well, what about you? You ever consider running for Congress?
Oh, I don't. I think I'm a little bit too politically incorrect on these things. No, I have never really considered it. I don't think there's a party that would have me.
Oh, well, you may be right about that. Might have to run as an independent.
Yeah.
All right. By the way, I wanted to go ahead and back you up there. What you said about if we leave, they're going to turn their attention somewhere else. And I thought I'd mention that in the book Dying to Win by Robert A. Pape from the University of Chicago, my interview of him at weekendinterviewshow.com. He makes it clear, and he proves it with mathematics, that when the occupation ends, recruitment dries up, period. And that the idea that somehow Bin Laden's going to be able to make himself the king of the Middle East or something is preposterous. As soon as America is gone, Al-Qaeda disappears.
Well, it disappears at least as a threat to the United States. As a threat to the local governments, that's a different story. But Pape's book is an excellent book, an extraordinarily important book. And I hope your readers go out and buy it, because I think it's a major contribution to this debate.
Absolutely. I agree with that. In fact, everybody, I wrote an article about my interview with Pape for antiwar.com called Poisonous Misinterpretations, where I take all the best Michael Scheuer quotes and Robert Pape and everybody else and throw them together for you there.
I reviewed Pape's book, too, on antiwar.com, and I called it Throwing America a Life Preserver.
Ah, there you go.
And I think he's done a real service to his country, Scott.
Yeah, I do too. He's a great guy. Everybody, go to antiwar.com and look down additional contributors. There's me, Scott Horton, and Michael Scheuer, the former head analyst of the CIA's Bin Laden Unit, Alex Station, and author of Imperial Hubris. Thanks again for coming back on the show, Mike. I really appreciate it.
A pleasure, Scott. You're always very kind to me, and anything I can do to help, I will.
All right. Take care. We'll be back next week, everybody. Antiwar.com.